Coming up on this In Contra special, the fifth of seven episodes examining American media, I'm Ilan Stavitz.
And I'm Ray Suarez.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.
As I've covered American culture as a reporter over the years, I have been always mystified, always intrigued by the role that the language police plays in our common life. People listen for cues of education, for grammar, for accent, for region, for all kinds of things in other people's speech in order to place them in a context, which is perhaps a more benign way of thinking of it, or for judging them. And right now, in our current family fights about who gets to come, who gets to stay, what the rules are going to be, the role of language takes up an outsized portion of our obsession with who's going to come and who's going to stay. Varieties of English and English or not is where the battle comes down. And Ilan, this is something you've written about a great deal, thought about a great deal, worried about a great deal. Where do you come down?
To me, language, Ray, is the channel, the prism, the lens through which I perceive just about everything. I like often to quote a sentence from the Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said, "The measure of my world is the measure of myself. That which cannot be said does not exist." And I find the metabolism of language, the connection that it has with society, to be the source of much of the identity wars that we are engaged in. What attracts me to the United States, what brought me here, was the hope to one day to be able to communicate with you in a language that wasn't mine, that was not part of my original verbal environment. And to do so not as a pariah, not as a constant tourist or outsider, but eventually with an accent, with something distinct, to be able to be part of the larger conversation that is the United States. It seems to be that any way we look at assimilation, it is language that is at its core. When we are able to learn the language, we are able to be part of that community. At the same time, that doesn't mean that by learning the English language, one should or ought to sacrifice any other languages one has come with. America has changed in that respect. It used to tell its immigrants, learn English, forget Yiddish or German or Italian or French, because this is the United States. With bilingual education, with the English-only movement or the English-first movement, it said to people, speak English. Speak anything else you want, but speak English in order for the rest of us to be able to communicate with you.
Speak English whenever I can hear it is what it comes down to, because there are all these laws and strictures. Workplaces will put rules and restrictions into place that prevent two workers who are conversing only between themselves. It will forbid them from speaking to each other in a foreign language, even though they both speak that language and are only speaking to each other. That's something more like anxiety, the willingness to control. When someone walks away from the counter of a drugstore in Miami, angry that the woman at the shop counter had a hard time expressing herself in English, that person has no idea whether the woman behind the counter has been here 10 minutes, 10 months, or 10 years, but is willing to judge her in a very harsh manner. And basically, in many cases, come to the conclusion that they, quote unquote, they never learn English. And part of this is wrapped in mythology, smothered in an inexact memory of who we were and how we got to be who we were. So I always hear stories about how people's ancestors quickly learned English And I know it's not true, because the older you were when you arrived in this country, the less likely you were to eventually be able to speak grammatical, intelligible, what we would call good English. Mm. The older you were when you arrived in this country, the less likely you were to ever master that. And we know from the ways that people got here that often they went straight to the farm, straight to the mill, straight into the mine, and in fact continue to speak the language, whether it's Czech or Italian or Polish, that they came with, whether it was in a shoe factory in Haverhill, Massachusetts, or a brewery in Missouri, or a mine in western Pennsylvania, or a steel mill in northern Indiana. When you go to the skeletal remains of some of these places, and you go to the cafeteria, for instance, the warning to not throw silverware into the garbage with your food scraps is posted in six languages. And if your grandfather learned English right away, apparently he still needed to be told in Polish not to throw out his knife and fork in the garbage. There is this crazy mythology that is meant to throw scorn and judgment on the immigrants of today, when in fact, much of the social intercourse you have with them happens in English, and the witnessing that you do to their continued language proficiency in Urdu or Hindi or Chinese or Vietnamese or Spanish happens when you witness them speaking to other people. They would never speak to you in Vietnamese. So the problem, the quote-unquote problem that you see around this is one of just perceiving that there is a part of the old country that remains in these people. And it makes people upset and angry and want to drive out that language. I hear complaints about walking up to a polling station in Los Angeles and finding no electioneering signs in five languages because it's Los Angeles. Well, so what? Do you want no electioneering, or do you want to tell people who don't speak English that they have to put up a sign that says no electioneering in English so that they don't understand what it means? I'm not sure what the social utility of some of this anger and dismay is.
All that is true, and you know my heart is with the argument so beautifully, so eloquently presented by you is. But I fear there is a manipulative approach in it, and I'll tell you why. The truth is that whenever there's a referendum about language and education, about language and the media, it is the immigrants often, and often the immigrants who not necessarily speak the English language, who will be in favor of having English alone, even at the expense of their own language. When in Arizona or in Massachusetts, there were referendums on the future of bilingual education, and to this day, scientists, social researchers have said, well, there was a manipulative approach by a variety of forces that came in and persuaded the immigrants that they should vote against bilingual education because it was going to undermine the potential for a better future. That is the typical approach, and it compares to thinking that children are always more ignorant than adults, that students don't know what their professors do, and that the electorate is always manipulated. The truth is, very many immigrants will vote for only English precisely because they have not been able to learn the language as fast as they want it, and they want their children to be able to speak the language. But this is complicated. I think of the Jewish arc of assimilation, of which I am kind of tangentially part. I came from Mexico, but I am Jewish. There's a belonging to this, but I don't come from the Eastern European landscape the way the first immigrants that were Yiddish-speaking did. I come from the Hispanic world. And the very first immigrants, the ones we were talking about in the previous episode, the ones that read the Jewish Daily Forward, the ones that communicated in Yiddish, strove to be able to have their kids only use English. They actually ceased to speak Yiddish because of that dream. And many descendants of those Jewish immigrants will tell you that the language was used for them not to understand what their parents were saying about their sexual life or money issues or whatever the neighbor was doing, and that Yiddish became a kind of forbidden language of that which you could not know except for a few words like schmuck and schmendrick and pipik and fossilized terms that have entered the larger lexicon. And what happens with the grandchildren of those immigrants and the great-grandchildren? There's a nostalgia for a language that was lost. There's a sense that, oh, if my parents had only learned the Yiddish that my grandparents spoke, they would have passed it to me. And now I would not be as single-sidedly monolingual and maybe reduced, that's what it means, that the American that I am, I would be able to, through Yiddish, communicate in a bit of Polish or in a bit of Lithuanian or Russian or German or what have you. Some immigrant groups have been quick to give up their immigrant language in search of the American dream. America has changed, and after World War II, the majority of immigrants coming to this country no longer came from the old world, meaning Europe. They now came from Asia and Latin America and Africa, and there was a different disposition to language. Now, schools no longer said, give up Swahili or Hindu or Spanish or Portuguese, keep it, but learn English. And that created maybe a bifurcated mind in children. You could have the two. Bilingual education was seen by conservative groups as dangerous because it could foster a double loyalty. Who are you? Are you still Argentine or Cuban or Dominican? Have you become fully American? But where I want to go with all this is into the realm of media and language. We were talking about the dark corners of the internet, and we were talking about media as an opioid. I have had many students recently who are gamers, who had rivalries with their parents because they did nothing but play games every hour of their days when they were not in school. And they are wonderful students. They are very perceptive students. My initial reaction would be, what a wasted life. It's the wrong reaction. These guys are sharp and quick and motivated and curious.
And it is mostly guys.
It's mostly guys. Though there are also girls, it's mostly guys. There's also another side, and that is when I come across young immigrants, they tell me that one of the beauties of the American media, television, the Netflix, other shows, is that they learn the English language by simply watching and not understanding. That the exposure that they had to it every afternoon that they turned it on in their living room, wherever they were, and heard an American English accent, enabled them to enter this society. And, you know, I would never be thinking here in front of you that American media is a pedagogical tool, but here I am saying exactly that.
At the same time, it's making us smarter, it's making us stupider, which is part of the problem. But yes, it's a very powerful transmitter of cultural norms. And what's language except the dressing that we put on all our cultural norms, the clothes that mm-hmm. our cultural norms wear? The anxiety that people have around language is fascinating to me because it helps stamp their decision as the right one. For every person who regrets that they no longer speak the language of their grandparents, there's a person who is ready to fight for that choice, to be less than my family was a generation ago, to be able to express ourselves less than we used to be, and think that that was the right choice, and also judge people who are making a different choice. The people who own Spanish language media in this country are constantly buying studies, they're constantly buying polling, they're constantly buying data, because they just don't know which American model is going to prevail for much of the rest of the century. If the United States cuts back on the amount of immigration from the rest of the hemisphere, will today's Spanish-speaking Americans follow family trajectories that more resemble ones from earlier in our history, so that their own grandchildren will only be able to say certain expressions, certain names of foods, certain religious phrases? Or will they, because of the proximity of Latin America and the ubiquity of Spanish media, radio, television, and the web, maintain a language with American characteristics that makes this experience a different one from the experience of the Germans, the experience of the Swedes, the experience of the Yiddish speakers? It's a fascinating question, and they're vitally interested in it because they have to know whether to zig or to zag. One of the companies is putting out a new network called Fusion, which was at first imagined as a bilingual network, now is basically English dominant because it has a Spanish lilt to it, a Spanish flavor to it. Many of the personalities who appear on the air are American-born, American-raised Latinos, but it is not that network that was going to be the place where people moved as they became English dominant. It's now for young people.
And if that is the case, for how long will those young people remain loyal to that network? You can see Spanish as the reason why people are going to return to Univision or Telemundo, because that's the way they understand the world. But when they have fusion in English, with that tilt that you were presenting, that is Latino, what will prevent them from switching to any other channel that doesn't have that tilt but makes them feel more interest in any particular topic and that freedom? Because what the remote control is all about is the freedom to serve, the freedom to choose, and the freedom to go anywhere you want and be anyone you want. One of the beauties of the media, maybe one of the traps too, is that it enables you to be whoever you want for however long you want. We are, as you said, very close to Latin America, that is Latinos. For an Italian to retain some loyalty to Italy and to Italian, there were many, many miles to travel. There were many dollars to invest. And it was a world without technology. For somebody living in San Diego of Mexican descent to go back to Mexico, it takes literally 10 minutes. Just cross the border, and the border has already crossed. You'll have Spanish language radio. Everybody will be speaking Spanish on your neighborhood, depending on where you are. I sometimes think of a map where the Latin America is at the top and the United States is at the bottom because the map has been inverted, and you shake the page of the map. And now it is Latin America that has infiltrated the United States. But as you're saying, this stop of immigration might change everything, might change dramatically. The same thing might happen if all of a sudden communist China collapses and there is an outflow of Chinese in dramatic ways that comes to the United States, not only to Oregon and Washington, but to the country at large. And all of a sudden, Spanish is not the most important second language, but it's Mandarin or Cantonese. There's another element that I want you to, or I want to go with you. That is the question of what is this English language itself and how it changes. Because what is fascinating is that we don't speak the same language on the U.S. media in every corner of the media all the time. You go to a channel that is attracting African-American youth and you will hear something connected with Black English or Ebonics. You go to Fusion and you might hear Spanglish. You go to other different channels and you might hear, as you were saying, older people's English or English from one part of the country or from New Jersey or Texas, etc. So my question is how the words enter the language and how the words leave the language. When American politicians say, we the people, we the Americans, who is it that is understanding this? And to what extent the we, again, that you and I have been talking through this series, changes from 100 years ago to 50 years ago to 20 years ago to now in the amount of words that we use and how those words change. For instance, information superhighway. It used to be the term in the 80s. I remember Al Gore using the term information superhighway on television. I asked my students the other day how often they go on the information superhighway. They thought that I was joking. It's the internet or it's the web or words come in and out of fashion. And to what extent does the media put pressure for certain words to be adopted and adapted into the lexicon, thus also pushing other words out that become fossilized or relics of another era?
The answer to your question is significantly more complicated than it would have been had we been having this conversation 40 years ago. Right now, there are varieties of Black English that are in part maintained by the geographic and class isolation of Black communities. So there is less cross-pollinization with standard English because it's less often heard. You know, we have enormous accent regions in this country, partially because it's a big country without a lot of physical barriers. get on the flat Midwest somewhere in Ohio and just start driving across the country. You pass Kansas before you see a mountain. So we have very few barriers in the way that the home island, England, Scotland, and Wales, had physical barriers, micro regions for certain kinds of terms, for certain forms of English, for certain vowel forms, the way vowels were pronounced. We always had much bigger regions, but now we're also seeing the splitting up by class rather than region. So a teenage girl from San Diego sounds much more similar to a teenage girl of a similar class, upper middle class, let's say, in Winnetka, Illinois, than they did 50 years ago. There is less regionalism and more accent based on patterns of consumption and valorized forms of speech that are borrowed from admired celebrities, movies, music, and at the same time, various black terms of common usage are percolating into communities of white people as hip-hop becomes the single most popular form of musical entertainment. In record sales, in radio airplay, in downloads, in all the various ways we measure what music is catching fire, hip-hop now has given white youngsters a window, a limited window, a distorted window, an incomplete window, that may be, but a window into black culture that even in the face of geographical isolation, that is, the ghetto is still the ghetto, and your suburban community may be far away, but you have heard something, an emissary from that world has come to your world, and you can sing lyrics and sing using verb forms and linguistic forms that are in fact not culturally part of your linguistic inheritance at all. I'm sure your children don't speak English with a Spanish accent.
Absolutely.
My children don't speak with a Brooklyn accent, even though they've been around me and their mother. She's from Flatbush. I'm from Bensonhurst. They use certain words because they heard them around the house. The one who lives in New York once thanked me. She said, well, from listening to you guys, I know how to talk now because I live in New York. But more than that, you are more likely to pick up words from your environment, pick up accents from your environment, and pick up styles of speech from your environment that you will not get from your birth parent.
I want to talk about hip-hop in a second, but I want to push you a little farther. Why is class, you said now it's class that is enabling these groups to feel that they are part of a larger imagined community. Why class now? It's not that I'm questioning it. It's that I'm curious as to why class more than region, more than ethnic group. The fact that a girl in Chicago from the same class will speak with the like than a girl from Miami, in large part because of what she hears in the media, is that a phenomenon that is at once equalizing the classes across geographical dimensions and at the same time creating less porous, stricter divides between the haves and have-nots?
If you come from a suburb of Boston and are growing up upper middle class, I'm not a linguist and I'm not someone who's made systematic career-length study of this. I'm just observing it as I travel through this world.
But that's why it's so interesting.
I hear girls who talk like that girl who are from a similar class whose English is not based in the place that they're from. It's an accent with no place. Where working class kids will speak with a geographically defined accent. So if you're from the South Side, historically white neighborhood of Canaryville in Chicago, you're more likely to speak with a pronounced Chicago accent and use some of the forms of speech that they use than a person who comes literally from 15 miles away in Lake Forest or Evanston or Winnetka. That person sounds more like the person from Brighton or Brookline who's of a similar class than they do with the people who live 5 or 10 miles away from them, from Dorchester or Charlestown or someplace like that.
The hip-hop reference that you made is one that I'm very attracted to. One of the aspects that I adore of American culture is its fluidity, its plasticity, its ethereal, ongoing, transformative nature. And one of the characteristics of this constant transformation is the move from the periphery of culture to center stage of certain aspects that were initiated by an ethnic group, often by African Americans or by Latinos, in that they come from those regional working class landscapes. In the moment corporations embrace them, the moment the middle class becomes infatuated with them, they are adopted and adapted into the American style. So hip hop is no longer the exclusive domain of Black America. Hip hop is an American phenomenon, just like jazz is an American phenomenon, or graffiti is an American phenomenon. In that sense, there's a theft, an appropriation. This is a big word used these days, of a cultural artistic item that comes from a specific group that then is stolen from it and marketed, and in that sense becomes something that sells. So I'm thinking, for instance, of the baseball cap that is turned around, or the low-hanging pants, or the sneakers or tennis shoes that could have come in the 70s and 80s from a particular Bronx landscape, and today is the fashion of an entire young hip-hop generation. I'm thinking of how graffiti went from the subway cars that Mayor Ed Koch would try to exile from the city to the Museum of Modern Art, where they are praised and prized at very high value. There is a transition in terms of rebellion in this culture from the outskirts of society to the center. What the rebellion that wins is the rebellion that is commodified. And the same thing happens with language. The words that are threatening at a particular point, gangster rap, become aspects that define a generation within the center, only for those that are still in the periphery to be in search of new ways to rebel, because it's a constant give and take. And it's a give and take of the languages. I would say in this sense that as vilified as Black English can be, as vilified as Spanglish can be, they are the nutrient of mainstream standardized English. They are constantly feeding it and thus being stolen away, these elements, only to invent something new that the next generation will feel it represents it.
This American particularism is a way to tear American English away from its roots that were constantly nourished by other languages, by the borrowings from Italian, by the borrowings from French, by the borrowings from German. It's almost as if we want to say, oh, but now that we're borrowing from these other people over here, we're going to cut off history. We're going to end history. So this constant nourishment, this constant transformation now ends. We ossify, we fossilize the language. Instead of being this organic, living, breathing, sinuous thing that's always hearing things that it likes from elsewhere and bringing it on board. That's the 1,500-year history of English. That's not just the 50-year history of English. Why don't we declare that stuff over? We're not going to do that anymore. And instead of hearing Daddy Yankee and Jay-Z, instead we're now going to say, no, the story of English, we're not doing that evolutionary thing anymore. We're done with that.
You know, English is the only imperial language. Think of French, think of Spanish and Portuguese, think of Dutch, that doesn't have the equivalent of a royal academy to protect it. It doesn't have a legislative entity, often paid either by the monarchy or by taxpayers' money, endowed with the responsibility to catalog, to cleanse, to standardize, and to accept or reject words that come from whatever provenance and that make it to the dictionary. Often, these academies have prescriptive dictionaries. These dictionaries tell people how to talk, how to use the language. English doesn't have an academy and doesn't like descriptive dictionaries.
Well, that's exactly what's made English so dangerous, so alluring, and so adopted.
Right,
adopted in every corner of the world.
Because in the end, who is protecting the language? Maybe, I'm aware of the irony here, maybe it is us, the media, us, the people who mess with it, who also, by virtue of our chaotic usage, keep it alive in a way that doesn't have any ownership. The ownership is both abstract and concrete.
As the to-ing and fro-ing, the tug of war about language will continue and just morph, change forms as we go forward, I think eventually market forces will take care of a lot of these questions. One thing market forces is having a hard time taking care of is just the complete oversaturation of the American population by media in all its forms. And in our next episode, we'll talk about the shakeout. We'll talk about a population that is now up to its eye teeth in content and can't make sense of it all. See you next time, Ilan.
Let us know what you think about this In Contrast special. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. To find out more about all of our In Contrast programs, visit our website at nepr.net/incontrast. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans.
And I'm Ray Suarez. Thank you for listening.
In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.